From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
The story of the UK is an economy that has got real momentum.
What is broken can be repaired. What is ruined can be rebuilt.
UK inflation is becoming much more homegrown.
We have huge potential as an economy in the UK.
This is a time to tell Israel there is a path to peace.
Our plan for the British economy is working, but the work is not done.
You're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Stephen Carroll.
And I'm Caroline Hepke. Welcome to the programme. Today, we're going to wade into the murky financial flows of Thames Water and all of its issues as the company publishes its new business plan today.
Yeah, indeed, lots of water puns to come as well. But the Prime Minister has also been speaking this morning about the Rwanda deportation bill. He says the first deportation flights will leave for Rwanda within 12 weeks. Now, his flagship immigration bill, as we've been talking about on this programme, has been held up in the Lords for months. They say it's unconstitutional. Sunak has pledged to keep Parliament voting on Monday until the upper chamber allows it to go through.
No more prevarication, no more delay. Parliament would sit there tonight and vote no matter how late it goes. No ifs, no buts. These flights are going to Rwanda.
Is that tough message going to mean that the Prime Minister gets his way on this key item? Well, we'll keep an eye on that. But we also want to talk about something else, something that will affect 25% of the UK population, that has implications for how Britain is run and could yet become a major election issue.
So we learned today that Thames Water needs an extra £1.1 billion for its 2025 to 2030 business plan in order to fix chronic leaks and sewage spills in its network. The plan the company's presented to the regulator Ofwat sees a total of nearly £20 billion in investment spending and a 40% increase in bills for its 16 million customers. But it still doesn't have the backing of its shareholders. For more details, we're joined now by energy and environment reporter Jess Shankelman and also Luca De Paoli from our debt team as well. Jess, let's start with you. Can you explain what's the point of this business plan that Thames has presented today?
That's a very good question. You have to take a step back here. So the business plan, all the companies submitted their own business plans to the regulator in October last year. They've all updated their business plans after having a back and forth with the regulator and with the environment agency. Tweaks here, tweaks there, a bit more spending on the environment. Thames is the last one to come forward with its update. And that's what we've got today. It has to do it. And it's kind of going through the motions because we don't know what the future holds for Thames Water in the next couple of months, the next couple of years. And this is a plan that goes out to 2030.
Yeah, so what's the background to all of this? I mean, the immensely difficult position that Thames Water is in now. How has it come about? And if you say if the five-year business plan is just kind of box-ticking at the moment, what's the nub of the issue?
Debt. Thames is the most heavily indebted of all the water companies, the water and sewage companies. It needs money to fund, firstly, a turnaround plan to fix all these chronic leaks and sewage spills over the next year in the current price review period, which ends next year. And then it needs another £2.5 billion, or possibly more, actually, that we learnt today, after what we've learnt today, to do everything else, like, you know, deal with drought caused by climate change. It's trying to build a giant new reservoir. It's trying to do water recycling. And its shareholders have said they're not prepared to put any more equity into the business. So if it can't raise debt and it can't raise equity, it's not really clear where it's going to get any more money from. Now, the CEO has said, CEO is Chris Weston. He started in January because the previous CEO, she quit abruptly in July, if you remember. He said there's enough money, they've got enough liquidity to last them until July next year, 2.4 billion. But, I mean, the clock is already ticking down. It was 15 months when he announced it. It's now 14 months. You know, by the time the election comes around, when are we expecting that? We're not sure, maybe in the autumn. It's going to be getting very, very tight. And I think, you know, the government is going to be worried about people starting to panic buy, for example, if they're worried that Thames might not be able to operate.
Yeah, indeed. This seems like a good point to bring in Luca Giapparli, who is our distressed debt reporter, an expert in this field. Luca, how much distress is Thames Water in from a market's point of view?
So there are two parts to Thames Water's structure, which debt investors have a stake in. One of them is a Kemble, which is the holding company, which effectively bought Thames quite a long time ago, and you have debt stapled to that. That debt is trading at a very, very deep discount, and the market seems to be pricing in the insolvency of that company. Underneath that is a regulated entity, Thames Water Utilities Limited. The debt from there is also trading at a discount, although not as drastic. The fear for those holders is that if there is a state-managed insolvency, what's called a special administration, they could end up with haircuts being, forced discounts onto their debt, meaning that they're going to get paid less than they would have initially lent to the company. So they are all worried about this prospect. And this is something which is, you know, looking more and more likely all the time. We're not necessarily at the stage where there'll be a special administration tomorrow, but the market started to price it in over the last few weeks in a way which it wasn't previously. You'd speak to a number of debt investors who would say, well, I'm lending to Thames Water's regulated entity, the entity that sits underneath, not the holdco, so I feel pretty safe. Those people don't feel as safe anymore.
That's really interesting, isn't it? And it does, as you have both pointed out, seem to be something of a race against time, because the creditors are getting jittery and the government, meanwhile, Luca, is saying, we really don't want to sort of bring this into special administration. We don't want to have to provide a taxpayer bailout. I mean, what has the government said about this so far? And what does that mean for creditors as they sort of calculate what might happen?
So the government's been working behind the scenes. Earlier this year, it updated its special administration legislation for water companies, because those insolvency rules dated back to the 90s and they were very complicated and confusing. And now they've kind of created like a pre-package, off-the-shelf packet that effectively, if they did bring them into special administration, they would be able to break the company up, because it is just so huge, it makes it very difficult to find an investor.
So essentially it would create more water companies serving the same area?
Yeah, I mean, people have been talking about this for years, because Thames serves London, but it also serves, you know, right out to Oxfordshire and Reading. And so one proposal is you could have an urban and then a rural business. You could try to split up the water supplier and the sewage supplier, because we do have companies that supply only water. So you could end up with four different companies. It would just make it those pieces a bit more bite-sized and able to kind of get their investment, and also then a bit more able to manage as well.
Luca, how do you think that investors are thinking about that sort of idea at the moment, in terms of the nearness of perhaps a government intervention?
So for equity holders, that doesn't, you know, this has been a spectacularly bad investment, I think it's fair to say, at this stage. And, you know, that's why they're not willing to put any more money in. It would be throwing good money after bad. For the debt holders, the ones at the regulated entity, the big concern for them is that in order to right-size Thames Water's balance sheet, some debt will have to be cut. If that debt is cut, that leaves them with losses. They obviously have investors that they need to explain this to. And then the other concern is that if you have the largest water company in the UK, where debt holders are not going to get their money back, and, you know, it's important to take a step back here. I think one of the reasons that people invest in companies like this from the debt side is because they think it's very safe. You know, this is effectively almost a public company, almost the same risk as the UK government. Some people would have priced in a long time ago. Now it doesn't look like that at all. So if you're having debt holders faced with losses, how are you incentivizing people to invest in the sector in the future? It needs a lot of investment, and are people less likely to provide it if, you know, bondholders could end up losing 50% of what they'd initially invested, 25% depending on where they are in the stack?
I think the question really at the moment is Thames an example of wider problems in the industry, off what the regulator has cracked down on dividends being paid from utilities into their parent companies to service debt, and there are a number of companies that do that, or is Thames a bad apple? And I don't think that question's quite been answered yet. You know, people on the side of Ofwat argue that, well, you know, if you look at Severn Trent, they managed to raise $1 billion in equity very recently, so it's a healthy sector and there's still a lot of interest in it, in investment. But I think there's a lot of concern that if this scandal, this kind of crisis with Thames drags on and on, it is going to cause a lot of contagion in the industry, and all these companies need to raise. I think they've collectively set out to invest about over 100 billion over the next 5 years in the water sector, and they need to be able to find that money from somewhere.
And we've been discussing actually the appetite from investors for these sorts of investments as well with Tony Dalwood from Gresham House. So they're an alternative asset manager who invest in building projects like renewable energy. Here's what he had to say about the broader impact of the debt situation at Thames Water.
What is critical is that there is consistency of policy. In order to get more investment into the UK, you need to have consistent government policy. If you start being able to invest in infrastructure for 10, 20 and 30 years, which some of these are, you can't have changes of policy every 2, 3, 4 years. And that will lead to people not wanting to invest if you end up in a situation where you can't trust policy to be consistent.
What, in this case, though, does consistent policy mean in your eyes?
Well, it's a tough one because you've got to go into the detail of whether the board has done its job in over-investing or under-investing in the infrastructure assets, whether it's distributed cash out of the company responsibly or not. That is something that's detailed for that particular situation, and one shouldn't simply say that then applies to the whole, in this case, water utility sector, or indeed a regulated utility sector.
That's Tony Dalwood there of Gresham House speaking to us a little bit earlier. Jess, I think you were interested perhaps by what Tony Dalwood was saying there.
Well, me and Luca have been talking a lot about the history of regulation in the water industry. And I think it's very interesting that he talks about consistency because as far as I understand it, a lot of these problems date back decades to when Ofwat regulation was very lax and allowed water companies to get away with raising debt levels to extremely high levels and not investing enough in the infrastructure. And it was around, I think, 2020, 2021, when Ofwat was able to get new powers from government to start cracking down on regulation. And it's kind of it's playing catch up now, but the horse has effectively bolted after the door was closed. And so we are seeing this huge amount of new policies. There's a huge focus from the government on cleaning up sewage, and so water companies are facing the most demanding price review that they have ever faced, really, this time.
Yeah, but as you say, the horse has bolted. I mean, this should have been done arguably sort of 30 years ago, if not, you know, maybe longer. I mean, Luca, how do you think about this in terms of what might flow from this, the fallout from this? How do you see this story developing? If you guys have obviously been focused on this for many months, what are you thinking about? What should our listeners be thinking about next?
So I think the next sort of really important thing that may happen is this moving into a special administration. We have special administrations for a company called Bulb, a sort of energy supply company. Mm. Other than that, it's normally reserved for financial companies. So this would be something weird, different, kind of unknown. As you were saying, this has been going on for 30 years. You know, Jess and I were talking to somebody about this earlier on. It's important to note quite how unusual this type of full-scale privatization of water is. You know, somebody we were speaking to mentioned Manila in the Philippines, but beyond that, we're kind of in a place where we don't have a lot of immediate comparables to look to. But if we get into a special administration, that will certainly have an impact on the wider sector. And there are other companies with a similar structure and, although not as highly levered, very levered companies as well. So what happens after after that to the sector more broadly? How are they going to get investment in? How will the model be affected? Because it's hard to look at Thames Water and suggest that this model has been a success.
Jess, what has the regulator said about this? How has Ofwat responded to the criticism of it?
Responded to the...
The criticism of it throughout this crisis.
I think Ofwat has its own battle to fight. There's been a huge amount of criticism of Ofwat from the industry for making regulations too tight. But I think that Ofwat is more focused on the consumer view, because Ofwat is effectively there to protect consumers. And there are political parties, not the current government and not Labour, but for example, the Lib Dems, who see Ofwat as basically useless and think that there should be a new regulator put in place. So from Ofwat's point of view, it has to show that it's really cracking down and standing up for the interests of consumers. And where Thames has in the last couple of months been asking Ofwat for leeway on all sorts of policies around the current price review, for example, the allowed return on investment or on penalties, Ofwat has feels quite strongly that it cannot be shown to be giving a company that has been heavily financially engineered in a way that has basically, you know, increased its level of debt to a very unsustainable level. It's producing unsustainable high levels of sewage. It's got the highest leaks in the country. And if Ofwat is giving leeway and making flexibility for Thames, it kind of makes a mockery of the whole regulation.
Okay, Jess, very interesting point. Thank you so much. That is our energy and environment reporter, Jess Shankerman, and Luca Di Paola. Thank you so much for joining us on the first part of the programme, thinking about Thames Water after the latest announcements and the business plan that was released today. I want to dive in a little bit to the aspect around, you know, the historic element of this. Thames Water, and I'll call it a fiasco because it is, surely, it leaves many with a lot of questions about the legacy from the whole privatisation era that took place under Margaret Thatcher. The UK state has outsourced all sorts of key infrastructure. I mean, it's not just water, it's also trains, telecoms, electricity, Royal Mail. The policy, at least in how it's been rolled out here in the UK, is now beginning to look pretty deeply flawed. Let's bring in Bloomberg Opinion columnist Matthew Brooker on this. Matthew, very good to have you in the studio. You've written in depth, actually, about this issue. The former Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, wanted to nationalise almost everything, I think, in the manifesto that he brought in the 2019 election. It was radical. It was rejected at the ballot box. Some voters now might not think that that's such an awful idea.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose you'd have to look at why Corbyn was rejected. It may not have been his policies on privatisation and renationalisation per se, but other things. But clearly, you know, what, 5 years on from the 2019 election, the whole legacy of privatisation doesn't look any better now than it did then. And in some ways, of course, you know, with particularly with what's happened with water, it looks a lot worse.
But I mean, this is something that's often talked about in political circles when, you know, the issues around Thames Water are being discussed. This is a failure of privatisation. Can we go as far as saying it's a complete failure of privatisation, or is it more a failure of specific issues around how it was done?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it depends on how you look at it, right? I mean, I think with water, you know, I went back and looked at what Water UK, the trade association, said themselves on the 30th anniversary of privatisation, which was, you know, look how far we've come. Look what things were like in 1989 when you had, you know, polluted rivers, polluted beaches, etc., etc. Now, if you're going to use that as your yardstick for progress, then privatisation absolutely has been a failure, because look, we've had 30 years probably 35 years now, during which some investors, not the current investors in Thames Water, but some investors have done very, very well out of water. And yet we have rivers and beaches that are more polluted than they were in the first place before water was privatized. And now we're facing this huge bill, you know, that runs into the tens of billions, I think possibly even the hundreds of billions when you look at the industry as a whole, to upgrade the infrastructure to compensate for the investment in maintenance and renewal that wasn't done during the years of privatisation, which was, you know, that was a reason for privatising in the first place. It was supposed to bring in investment capital that was going to do this work for us.
Okay, but some might also argue that the Thames Water story is one of climate change itself, and that's very difficult, isn't it? Because actually, a lot of the sewage discharge, as I understand it, is when you get a big deluge of rain and the sewage system can't cope, and then it sort of expels the sewage into the sea, and it's a bit of a climate change story.
That's absolutely part of it. I mean, it's a complex topic, and you can't reduce it to saying, I think, to binary choices of privatisation bad or public ownership good. It's changed not just climate change. I think it's, you know, changes in the landscape as well. We don't have as many kind of swamps and woods and green fields and wetlands as we used to have. You know, and if you have a topography that's characterized by tarmac and concrete and roads and whatever, when you do get these deluges, instead of being absorbed by the landscape, the water rushes into the nearest sewer, and then from there into the nearest river and the nearest sea. So that's absolutely part of it.
It's in some ways the lesson of privatisation, a cautionary tale to other countries that are looking at the idea of whether or not they should be privatising their utilities like water.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I think that of course the UK's privatisations in the 80s were enormously influential around the world. Many developing countries copied that model. It's interesting that most countries didn't privatise water, though. Water has remained in public ownership almost everywhere. So we're an outlier on that. And, you know, if you look at the results, you wouldn't conclude that the UK necessarily made the right decision there.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it may also be a lesson in terms of future privatisation. Remember, you know, one of the big issues also is the underinvestment, but the concerns around the strength of the NHS now, whether or not you have to privatise some elements of that. I mean, the Labour Party even looks open to that. Is there a lesson there for future years?
I do wonder about what effect disasters like the water industry are going to have on the whole debate over the NHS, because, you know, the kind of, I don't know if it's fair to call it privatisation or not, but, you know, the introduction of market mechanisms and private capital into the NHS has been enormously controversial, and clearly not an astounding success. And when you've got public opinion already biased against privatisation, you know, we've seen it, and it's gone, you know, in opinion surveys going back years. I mean, most people do favour having water, electricity, railways, Royal Mail, whatever, in public hands. So I do wonder how that is going to weigh on the NHS debate and what happens with the NHS in the future.
For those companies that are already been privatised in those sectors, is there any path back to public ownership in the way that some would be advocating for?
I don't think it's very likely. I mean, if you talk about water particularly, I mean, the government just doesn't want to bring all that debt back onto its own balance sheet. I mean, I'm not an expert in public finances, but I think it's we are debt constrained, and I think we can't necessarily afford it.
Does it also change the legacy of Thatcher?
Well, I think it does a bit. I mean, this is not recent, right? I mean, there have been many fiascos down the years. I mean, you know, Railtrack went bust. Various rail operators have lost their franchise or have been brought back into public ownership. I mean, there's various things you can look at. So I think the sheen has come off it, has come off privatisation for a long time. I mean, that said, I mean, the other side of the counter, I mean, when you look at water, I don't think the problem, you look at the causes of why we're in the situation that we are now, it was not the introduction of private capital itself that caused them. It was bad regulation. And I mean, even if it's fair to call it bad regulation, I mean, it was the industry was regulated in the way it was because of that's what the politicians wanted. You know, the political calculus was what we want is to keep bills down, customer bills down, and you know you can't have your cake and eat it. That's what happened, and this was the result.
Okay, Matthew Brooker, Bloomberg opinion columnist, thank you very much for joining us on the programme. And you can read Matthew's latest piece, Privatisation's Failures Are Stacking Up for the UK, on Bloomberg.com and, of course, on The Terminal.
Okay, much to think about, but that's it from us for today. If you like the programme, don't forget to subscribe and give it 5 stars so that other people can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify or wherever you listen.
This episode was produced by James Wilcock, and our audio engineer was Sean Guastamacchia. I'm Stephen Carroll.
And I'm Caroline Hepker. We'll be back with more tomorrow. This is Bloomberg.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.